Garcia is international relations coordinator at the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras. All week, Democracy Now! Will be breaking with convention as we cover the Democratic National Convention, which virtually begins this evening. We'll bring highlights of the speeches of everyone from Bernie Sanders tonight and Michelle Obama and others. That does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Phelps, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Adriano Contreras. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask. Thanks.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO the second Friday of every month at 8 p.m. for the KBOO Youth Randomonium. Are you interested in hearing what music real young people listen to? Are you interested in listening to local artists of all ages talk about and play their music? Then you've come to the right place. Tune into KBOO the second Friday of every month at 8 p.m. for the Youth Randomonium. All things young people, music, thoughts, opinions. Let's get radical. Right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protests in Portland against police brutality and systemic racism continue into their 12th consecutive week. COVID-19 numbers continue to rise in Oregon and across the country. And in international news, protesters in Thailand are calling for democratic reforms. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 17th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Sunday night marked the 81st night of protests in Portland against police brutality and systemic racism. Letha Winston, the mother of 27-year-old Patrick Kimmins, who was fatally shot by Portland police in 2018, addressed a crowd of demonstrators outside the Multnomah County Justice Center in downtown Portland. Winston said, quote, "We need to continue to keep marching. We need to continue to keep chanting. We need to continue to keep running. We need to continue to keep screaming. We need to stand tall through it all. Do not ever let anyone discourage you from getting justice. A change is going to come." After Winston spoke, the crowd began marching, gathering outside the Southwest 2nd Avenue entrance to the Portland Police Bureau headquarters and Central Precinct. At one point, Multnomah County Sheriff's deputies emerged and pushed people away from the entry to the Justice Center garage. A few blocks away, near Southwest Broadway and Taylor Street, a confrontation unfolded after a Ford truck slammed into a light pole. Several people kicked, punched, and pushed the driver to the ground. Video on social media shows the driver lying still on the ground with his eyes closed. It was not immediately clear what caused the violent confrontation, and police have released few details. Social media posts allege that someone had been driving erratically downtown and had tried to run over protesters, though those accounts could not be independently verified. The demonstrations came at the end of a weekend in which Portland police declared riots on Friday night in North Portland and late Saturday into early Sunday outside the Penumbra Kelly Building on East Burnside Street. The nonprofit Police Accountability Group, Don't Shoot PDX, has asked a federal judge to hold the city of Portland in contempt of a court order that restricted police use of tear gas and impact munitions. On June 26, the court ordered police to restrict their use of tear gas and so-called less lethal munitions to situations where lives or public safety are at risk. The June order was approved by U.S. District Judge Marco Hernandez and states that police are restricted from firing less lethal launchers into crowds if people engaged in passive resistance are likely to be struck. In addition, the order said that the Bureau's use of rubber ball distraction devices can be used only if the lives and safety of the public or police are at risk and shall not be used to disperse crowds in situations that do not pose risk or injury to the public or police. Handheld pepper spray canisters also cannot be used against people engaged in passive resistance, and police should minimize pepper spray exposure to peaceful demonstrators. Don't Shoot PDX alleges that Portland police have fired rubber bullets, charged, shoved, and hit demonstrators with batons to clear away crowds. The group's attorney, Jesse Merrithew, wrote in a motion seeking sanctions against the city. They wrote, quote, "Plaintiffs ask this court to impose sanctions that are reasonably calculated to prevent future contemptuous conduct by the city." Don't Shoot PDX now wants a judge to ban Portland police's use of certain less lethal weapons in any crowd control encounter, and to only allow an elected official, Mayor Ted Wheeler, who serves as police commissioner, to authorize the use of less lethal weapons. The group further wants a judge to prohibit police officers who have allegedly violated the court order from participating in other crowd control operations and fine the city to deter future violations. They specifically highlighted police actions late June 30th into July 1st outside the police union office on North Lombard Street. The court action comes as the city enters its 12th consecutive week of protests against police brutality and systemic racism, following the May 25th murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. On Monday, the Oregon Health Authority reported 192 confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19, bringing the state's total number of cases up to 23,451. The county with the highest number of new cases was Multnomah County with 57 new cases, followed by Marion County with 30 new cases. Health authorities did not report any new deaths on Monday, meaning the state's death toll remains unchanged at 388. Over the weekend, the Oregon Health Authority reported a total of 664 new cases of COVID-19 and 3 new deaths due to the virus. Officials also announced that beginning on Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority would begin reporting numbers on supplies and inventory of personal protective equipment in hospitals and medical facilities around the state. The information will be published weekly as part of the Hospital Capacity Report. In early July, every detainee at the Farmville Detention Center was tested for COVID-19, and nearly 90% tested positive. Diane Bernard has more on the story with the Public News Service.
A hearing today will determine new guidelines to keep the coronavirus in check at a Virginia ICE facility that's become a hotspot. A judge last week ordered immigration authorities to stop transferring people to and from the Farmville ICE facility after a lawsuit filed on behalf of the detainees. Simon Sandoval Moschenberg with the Legal Aid Justice Center says transfers at Farmville occurred without quarantine or testing, which led to what is considered the worst outbreak of coronavirus at any ICE facility in the nation.
The judge excoriated ICE for allowing these conditions to be created in the first place by transferring 74 detainees from two of the hottest hotspots in the country without actually testing them before doing so. So the judge recognized definitely that things are going to have to change quite dramatically.
In a statement, ICE officials say the agency is firmly committed to the health and welfare of all those in its custody and that it has taken extensive precautions to limit the potential spread of COVID-19. But 2 weeks ago, a 72-year-old Canadian detainee died at the Farmville Center after testing positive for the coronavirus. After that, Sandoval Moschenberg says ICE called in the CDC to review conditions at the facility as the outbreak spread.
What it goes to show is that we're dealing with a situation where even one slip-up can be fatal. And so the ordinary protocols that ICE have in place, which basically say, you know, when we can do this, we'll do it, and if it's too difficult for us, we won't do it, clearly aren't sufficient.
He says ICE is continuing its practice of transferring detainees between facilities across the nation, but the CDC is expected to make recommendations at today's hearing, along with medical advisors, to alter that practice. For Public News Service, I'm Diane Bernard.
A boat sunk on the Willamette River in downtown Portland as a Trump boat parade passed by over the weekend. The small passenger vessel was not affiliated with the rally. It took on water when it was swamped by waves created by other boaters. Videos of the episode were shared to Twitter, showing the passengers calling for help and eventually abandoning the boat as it began to sink. No one was injured, and all of the passengers were picked up by other boaters by the time authorities arrived. Firefighters are continuing to make progress on a wildfire that has been burning in the Columbia River Gorge since last Wednesday. The Mosier Creek Fire, located between Hood River and the Dalles, is now 65% contained. The fire spans about 1,000 acres and has already destroyed 36 structures and damaged one more. The State Fire Marshal's office personnel are scheduled to demobilize on Monday. However, evacuations remain in effect. The cause of the wildfires is currently unknown, but fire officials have said they believe it was likely human-caused. Other fires burning throughout the state include the Indian Creek Fire, which grew to about 8,000 acres overnight after being reported midday Sunday near Highway 20 at Jonesboro. The fire is burning on private, state, and Bureau of Land Management rangelands. Southeast of Lakeview, the Crane Fire is estimated to cover about 19,000 acres. A red flag warning for abundant lightning on dry fuels in the area remains in effect until late Monday night. A fire has also broken out in the Opal Creek Wilderness near Beachy Creek, covering about 10 acres as of late Sunday. The popular destination areas of Three Pools and Opal Creek were closed Sunday as authorities were working to facilitate evacuations. Portland and Vancouver are under an air quality advisory as of this afternoon. Smog levels have risen in the area and may be dangerous for certain groups. Those include children, pregnant women, seniors, and people with heart or respiratory conditions. Authorities recommend that these groups avoid going outside if at all possible. The advisory is expected to last until tomorrow morning, and in the meantime, the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality asks that people refrain from idling their car engines and other pollution-causing activities. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth roundup of protesting this weekend, as well as a look at the Clackamas County Children's Safety Levy, which will be on the ballot in November. Stick around at 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 68 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be again partly cloudy with a high of 86. Today in history, in 1969, the grooviest event in music history, the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair, concludes after 3 days of peace, love, and rock and roll in upstate New York. The quote of the day is from American writer and activist James Baldwin, who said, quote, "It is certain in any case that ignorance, allied with power, is the most ferocious enemy justice can have." Of the virtual Democratic National Convention. With that story and more, we go to Lily Bolke and 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Just his wealth of experience, having served as a senator since he was in his late 20s, being the vice president for, you know, one of the most popular presidents in modern history, Barack Obama. And I think just that experience and really leadership kind of echoed to me that, you know, he could kind of go into office and really restore the soul of this nation, as he says.
Victor Shi is a college freshman from Illinois and a Joe Biden delegate to the Democratic National Convention, which starts today virtually with hundreds of live video feeds from living rooms and home offices across the country. She is part of the Young Delegates Coalition, which includes 225 delegates under 36 from all across the country. During the early primaries, Senator Bernie Sanders had the most support from young people. But she says the Biden-Sanders joint task forces really made a difference once Sanders dropped out of the race.
So I think there is this willingness to listen to the younger folks and the folks who did support Bernie Sanders. And I think that's a really nice indication of, I guess, where the party's headed in the future, which is, you know, that we value all voices.
Some progressive activists, however, don't feel the party platform goes far enough. One sticking point is the decision not to include a Medicare for All plank. Representative Ro Khanna, who's part of the California delegation, voted no on the platform for that reason. And so did Sidney Jackson, a Sanders delegate from St. Louis, Missouri.
The majority of the state parties have some sort of language that embraces a form of Medicare for All, but on a national level, you know, it's just kind of disappointing that on a national level, we can't really seem to get behind that quite yet.
A few hours before Biden takes the stage, President Trump plans to deliver televised remarks, just a few miles from the Democratic candidate's hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania. The Trump campaign is also launching a major digital advertising push during the three main nights of the Democrats' convention. Yesterday, the U.S. Postal Service announced it will stop removing mail collection boxes until after the election, responding to concerns from postal employees who have reported such removals in recent weeks. The announcement came after protests at the home of Trump-appointed Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, accusing him of working with the White House to undermine vote by mail.
If you're planning to vote by mail, which I know a lot of people are, it's really important to do that process as soon as you can.
Ajay Sani is voting rights counsel with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling the chamber back for a vote to block recent changes in staff and procedures that have already resulted in mail slowdowns. Sani says it raises questions.
These are the kinds of things that really need to be sort of scrutinized further to figure out whether this is the right time to be engaging these types of actions, especially when we're sort of bailing very close to this election that's going to be highly dependent on the Postal Service for, you know, effective voting.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Turmoil around the U.S. Postal Service has continued in the lead-up to the November election, which will require many to vote by mail for the first time. Cuts by the interim director have alarmed many, as they say that the Postal Service is more critical than ever due to the pandemic. Members of the House of Representatives will be called back into session on Saturday due to this issue. House Democrats will spearhead an investigation into the Postal Service. Both the Postmaster General, William DeJoy, and the Chairman of the Postal Service Board will be called on to testify. Additionally, House members will vote on a bill to fund $25 billion to the Postal Service. The legislation would also prohibit the changes and cuts that have been made under the new Postmaster General and revert them back to how they were at the beginning of the year. Speaker Pelosi wrote to members of the House, calling them back into session ahead of their usual September meeting. She wrote, quote, "The Postal Service is a pillar of our democracy, enshrined in the Constitution and essential for providing critical service, delivering prescriptions, Social Security benefits, paychecks, tax returns, and absentee ballots to millions of Americans, including our most remote communities. Alarmingly, across the nation, we see the devastating effects of the president's campaign to sabotage the election by manipulating the Postal Service to disenfranchise voters." 10,000 anti-government protesters took to the streets in Bangkok, Thailand, at the Democracy Monument on Sunday. It was the largest rally of its kind since the military took political power 6 years ago. The movement began with student protesters at the last election, but now features demonstrators of all ages. Protesting the government in Thailand can be very dangerous. The country uses a constitutional monarchy system now, but the king is still looked at with extreme reverence. Insulting the royal family is a crime, and it is strictly enforced in Thailand. Under these laws, called lèse majesté, anti-government protesters have been severely punished or even disappeared. Thailand has been mostly spared by the coronavirus pandemic, but it has been hit hard economically in the aftermath. Demonstrators want their democratic rights to be protected, and a vocal minority has even demanded reform to the monarchy. Protesters displayed the three-finger protest signal from the book franchise The Hunger Games. They sang a Thai version of Do You Hear the People Sing from the musical Les Miserables and chanted, "Dictatorship must be destroyed and democracy will prosper." The University of Oregon will cover up controversial murals, and British Columbia releases a long-awaited mine cleanup plan. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the Daily Newscast. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the Daily Newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After years of criticism, the University of Oregon is covering up four murals. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, they're considered dated works which promote white supremacy.
The murals are in the Knight Library and were installed in the 1930s. One speaks of preserving our racial heritage, referring to white people. Others depict white scholars working above primitive indigenous people using crude tools. Angela Noah is a White Mountain Apache and sophomore at the U. She says the murals are oppressive and set low expectations for non-white students.
It's impacted my mental health, and the message that I get is, you're not welcome in these spaces. The space is not meant for you. I'm an older sister, so I would love to see my siblings come to school and not face so much that I have this past year.
Some of the murals have been vandalized in the past. Criticism has gained traction as the Black Lives Matter movement has surged this year. Because of how they're installed, removing the murals would destroy parts of the walls. So the U of O is having them covered up at the price of $32,000.
For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
British Columbia has released a long-awaited cleanup plan for the Tulsiquot Chief Mine. Tribes in Alaska and BC have been urging the province to clean up the defunct mine, which has been polluting the salmon-rich Taku River for years. The province last week announced the first steps of a cleanup plan in conjunction with the Taku River Tlingit First Nation. Tribes in nearby southeast Alaska praised the move. John Morris, senior of the Douglas Indian Association near Juneau, says it's not a done deal, but hopes to see full closure of the mine. State officials in Alaska have been urging the province to do more to stop the mine from leaching acidic runoff into salmon streams. Kyle Moselle is a state mining resource official.
This is progress. It's a complex effort that BC is taking on with addressing the legacy mining issues at the Tulsiquot Chief site. The state of Alaska has been involved and engaged with BC on that for a number of years. And I just want to emphasize that this is a positive milestone in that process.
The Taku River is one of the largest salmon-producing systems in the region, an important source of food and income for people in the area. Toronto-based creditors for the bankrupt mining company are trying to assert their claim in Canadian courts so they can resell the assets to another investor. A recent hearing in an Ontario court brought strong opposition from both the BC province and First Nation, which say the financiers have done nothing to stop the flow of pollution from the old mine. Two national Native organizations are expressing concern over the Bureau of Indian Education reopening schools, which include plans for in-person instruction. The National Congress of American Indians and the National Indian Education Association are raising concerns about the health and safety of students, staff, and community members. NCAI and NIEA are urging for the consultation with tribes before reopening and are urging for online instruction options. The BIE oversees more than 180 schools. Plans were criticized when released earlier this month, as many tribal communities have been hit hard by COVID-19 and continue to be under emergency orders. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A group of nuns have agreed to turn the site of the former convent into a flood prevention project. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans in 2005, the convent of the Sisters of St. Joseph was severely damaged by flooding. The nuns moved elsewhere while repairs began. But the following year, lightning struck the roof and started a fire. The convent could not be saved.
We began to pray for some kind of a insight that would enable us to use the property in a way that would minister to the people of New Orleans.
Sister Pat Bergen says an architect came to the nuns with an idea, converting the 25 acres into a wetland that helps prevent flooding in nearby areas. They're calling the project the Mirabeau Water Garden. Plans for the site include recreational areas, meadows that absorb stormwater, and retention ponds. When the city's drainage system is overwhelmed, water will be diverted to the property and held there until it can be safely released.
Healing, strengthening, restoring earth was a major part of our decision making, and that's why this design resonated with our hearts right away.
So when the city breaks ground, it will turn what was once a major loss into a gain for the flood-prone city of New Orleans. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
In the U.S., 74% of communities of color live in nature-deprived areas, compared with just 23% in communities that are considered white. Eric Gladys has more on the story with the Public News Service.
As the nation grapples with systemic racism in the wake of George Floyd's killing by Minneapolis police, a new report shows that communities of color are three times more likely than white communities to live in areas considered to be nature deprived. Shauna Edberg with the Hispanic Access Foundation and report co-author says people of color who are disproportionately suffering from COVID-19 can't access the health benefits of green spaces.
Access to nature promotes an active lifestyle. Greenery absorbs pollution, and pollution is found to be one of the risk factors for COVID-19. So, you know, it's not just this kind of ideal that we'd like to have. It's people's health and mental wellness.
The report by Edberg's group and the Center for American Progress found that families in low-income neighborhoods and communities of color do not have adequate access to safe, close-to-home parks and other green spaces. 70% of low-income communities across the country live in nature-deprived areas. In Colorado, Hispanic and Latino communities are more likely to live in the shadows of power plants, refineries, and oil and gas operations than any other racial or ethnic group. Jenny Roland Shea with the Center for American Progress says the data confirms that the stark disparities are not a result of chance, but decades of systemic inequalities and environmental racism,
including practices of redlining, a long history of prioritizing parks in white neighborhoods, siting factories and energy projects in communities of color, even literally paving directly through or over diverse neighborhoods.
Roland Shea says state and local governments can help reverse inequities by prioritizing new parks and greenway projects in communities of color and changing hiring practices so that staff and related government agencies, nonprofits, and foundations better reflect the nation's diversity. The report's recommendations also include protecting at least 30% of natural landscapes in the U.S. by 2030. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Gladys.
According to the U.S. Apple Association, only 15 varieties make up 90% of apple production. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Lost apple varieties of the Northwest are sprouting anew and in the spotlight at a conference this week. The University of Idaho is hosting the second Heritage Orchard Conference, albeit at a distance this year. On Wednesday, retired law enforcement investigator and apple sleuth for the Lost Apple Project, David Benscotter, will talk about hunting down these unique fruit specimen. Benscotter says he can identify where the pioneers were likely to plant an orchard in the hilly terrain of northern Idaho and eastern Washington.
Some kind of a ravine or something like that. They'd stick their fruit orchards right in the bottom of that area. And those ravines would act as natural gutters, and so they'd get more water than if they were to be planted on top of a hill.
The Lost Apple Project is part of the Whitman County Historical Society in eastern Washington. Wednesday's presentation begins online at 10 a.m. and is free to the public. The Heritage Orchard Conference is holding webinars once a month through next April. Benscotter says Northwestern pioneers had about 300 varieties to choose from, and the Lost Apple Project is looking for about 40. Early settlers had many more types of apples to choose from than we do today. The U.S. Apple Association says only 15 varieties make up 90% of production. Benscotter calls many of the varieties he rediscovers ugly little apples that taste great but don't have much commercial value. Still, he says these forgotten fruits can teach growers today a lot.
A couple of the apples that we have found have been reported to have some excellent resistance to some apple diseases.
Benscotter says the best locations are old homestead sites and that the project gets a lot of support from the public on where to snoop for apples.
We're just hoping that a few of these have somehow survived and maybe are tucked away in the back of somebody's lot or a field somewhere.
He adds that the Temperate Orchard Conservancy in Oregon deserves a lot of credit. The Lost Apple Project sends samples there to identify apples for the sleuths. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 17th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings, Claire Rosciato, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Diane Bernard, Eric Tegedoff, Eric Galatis, and Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, Alternative Radio features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Stage and Studio. Host D-May Roberts talks to Portland-based artist Horatio Hoon-Yun La about creating art in solitude. At 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last week, the Clackamas County Board of Commissioners unanimously voted to refer the Children's Safety Levy to the November ballot. If passed by voters, the measure would raise over $7 million each year for at least 5 years for Clackamas County organizations that work directly with children, youth, and families surviving abusive and unhealthy living environments. This means the opportunity for more staffing and better access for children and youth living in unsafe situations. As my guest today, Simon Fulford, the executive director of Parrot Creek, a nonprofit that works with parents, children, and adolescents in need, shares funding is needed now more than ever given the pandemic. Many nonprofits that work with children and youth are often the first point of contact for at-risk children experiencing violence at home, abuse, and neglect. Here's more with my conversation with Simon Fulford.
Can you tell us how, if this levy is passed by the voters in Clackamas County, how that will help your organization?
That's an excellent question. So, you know, the ballot measure and the levy itself would raise, possibly up to about $7.5 million per year that would be targeted for these, you know, for these much needed services for children victims of abuse and violence and neglect or exposed to that. No one organization is at all named in the ballot measure and in any of the language, because that's inappropriate. But the idea behind the levy is, you know, a lot of this need of our children and families is going unmet. There are lots of services and provision out there, but we know that many, many kids kind of fall through the cracks. They go unnoticed, and abuse and neglect sort of, you know, as it were, adversely affects their lives. And then they do come onto the radar. They may end up in hospital, or you know, they're noted by a teacher or something like that. So the intent of these funds is to really fill some gaps in those services. And organizations such as Parrot Creek Child and Family Services, but any organization that is providing this type of service in Clackamas County would be eligible to apply for these funds through some sort of contracting scheme that the county will be supervising. So for Parrot Creek in particular, you know, we provide some very intensive residential programs. We do some outpatient treatment, and it's very likely that those types of services that we offer would fit with the criteria, and so therefore we would propose to increase that capacity to provide, you know, additional beds for youth who are unsafe in their homes and don't have homes to go to. It might be that we would, you know, use funds to provide, you know, intensive outpatient treatment for youth who have been victims of abuse and neglect. And then there's other organizations that might be, you know, proposing to provide those, you know, very intensive assessments of youth, children who have been exposed to abuse, to do that assessment and to get them the appropriate medical and psychological support. And then there's a whole prevention side of it, organizations that work more on the preventative side, who work in schools or work in communities, who identify vulnerable children, vulnerable families, where there is a kind of a higher likelihood of abuse or neglect or exposure to violence to happen, and to put in place services, wraparound supports, protective factors that might help ensure that those kids are not exposed to trauma.
Something I'd like to know, and I think many listeners would want to know as well, is given the COVID-19 pandemic, many schools are closed, many after school programs, many activities in areas where children would normally be outside of the home, for the most part, aren't open. So for mandatory reporters, they're not necessarily around to keep a check on children and youth who are being abused or suspected of being abused. Can you talk about why this type of funding is critical, especially right now?
That is a really excellent question, and it certainly wasn't kind of part of our thinking in, you know, 10 years ago, as sure. It were, although it was, my answer will get to how it was somehow in our thinking, but really as the coronavirus pandemic kind of deepened and expanded in our communities, it really brought to the fore where this type of measure and this type of initiative could really be even more powerful and impactful in our communities, because you've highlighted exactly a real challenge that our communities and our families are going to face. Kids will not be in school for the foreseeable future. Kids will not be in some of those after-school programs, some of those camps and clubs where there are caring adults who look after them, who are mentoring them, who also, as you said, have those eyes on them and might notice a child coming in with bruises, a child's behavior or their kind of demeanor changing and being more upset, and being able to talk to them and find out what's happening and how they can best serve them. That won't be happening nearly as much. And where nonprofit community-based organizations can really basically come in and fill a gap, and through these additional funds we'll be able to fill that gap even more, is community-based organizations are still interacting with children and families. Some of it is happening remotely, but they are on the ground. They work with families day to day. They mobilize local volunteers. They have staff who are based in and come from our local communities. So they provide basically another kind of layer or another group of professionals who do have eyes on kids, and who are seeing them sometimes in sort of less formal structures of school and after school programs. If the kids aren't there, they may still be involved with an organization that's doing something slightly less formal in the community. And they have those relationships with families, those trusted relationships, where families who may be worried about something that's happening to someone, a child, or who see it in others, when they're not engaging with the kind of more formal system, they will often use, you know, trusted individuals, trusted organizations that they know in their communities to raise their concerns or their fears, to put kids on the radar and attention of nonprofits. And that's the role that we want to play, as organizations that have really been advocating for this, is to say we can actually be another a kind of a stronger additional layer and sort of that safety net, and where if a child isn't going to be in school, and so teachers won't notice those bruises, there are actually community organizations that still have a good likelihood that they might see that kid and be able to intervene earlier and sooner rather than later.
Absolutely.
And
go ahead.
Kind of dig into that anymore if you would like to.
Yes, please. And if you could relate to how this is operating during the pandemic with certain regulations and restrictions, that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, so how this could look in how this could look in practice is how some of us are already operating, mm-hmm. and how, you know, a lot of community organizations continue to adapt and evolve to how do we keep our community safe because of COVID-19, but at the same time make sure that we are interacting and engaging with kids. You know, a lot of organizations had to kind of move to a more remote way of working with clients in the short term when the pandemic was kind of very unknown and mm-hmm. none of us knew quite what we should be doing, and did we have enough PPE, did folks have enough face masks and other protective equipment to safely engage with families and communities. I think we're now very much through that. Not very much through, we're through that, and I think we've all learned how to be safe but actually be working with families face to face. To use Parent Creek as an example, you know, we now have procured, we've been donated, we've bought protective equipment, face masks, gloves, masks, you know, face shields, things like that, hand sanitizer. So we are out in the community, we are engaging with children and families, and we do some of that health screening before we might, you know, sit down and talk to them. We meet with them outdoors. We do some safety around not necessarily going into homes in the ways that we used to, and very much engaging in that trusted conversation with our children and families to say, hey, we all know that COVID-19 is an issue right now. How do I help keep you safe? Could you wear this mask? How do you help keep me safe? You know, here's what we will do together. And so that will be the ways with this levy support, is that organizations like Parent Creek, Children's Center, Clackamas Winter, whoever it will be that may be applying for these funds, will basically be able to mobilize more staff to respond safely within the kind of coronavirus pandemic, but actually reach more kids.
Wow, that's amazing that your organization and others have been keeping up the fight to help children and youth in Clackamas County, despite all of the safety needs or safety requirements because of the coronavirus.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And it's been something that's changed, you know, it's been all, you know, sometimes it's changed daily or weekly.
Sure.
I want to say sometimes it's felt like it's changed hourly, but that might be a small exaggeration. But it has been, you know, having to really respond on a constant basis to, you know, additional information from guidance, whether it's county guidance, state guidance, CDC guidance, but always with that view is, you know, we don't want to be, our staff don't want to be kind of stuck at home not engaging with kids and families. They want to be out there meeting them face to face in a safe way. And so the question that we've always been asked in all these organizations is, so how do we keep our staff safe? How do we protect the clients and the participants or the community members we work with? But how do we make sure that we are out there providing those services? And I think that's, you know, that kind of nimbleness and that ability to respond quickly and adapt on a kind of almost daily basis is when nonprofits excel and community-based organizations excel. They are able to respond very quickly and to see an emerging need, to see maybe a very, very localized crisis, and can almost respond in the moment. Often, you know, kind of more official agencies, they are fantastic in their response, and they have often sort of, they can mobilize kind of greater resources, but that's often what sort of that follow-up that happens. And if you take a, you know, a natural disaster emergency as an example, and not to pick on FEMA because they're an amazingly formidable agency and they do some amazing work. But when you think of some of those stories of a hurricane or an earthquake, you often see local families, local organizations, they're kind of like the first groups to mobilize and respond. You have your first responders, the police and the fire and the emergency services. But once you're talking about kind of rebuilding a community or responding to those emerging needs, it's often those very localized organizations that figure out what children and families need most in that moment. They often provide that kind of first layer of response. And then they help those same children and families access the kind of more formal types of services and supports that they may need. And so this may be, these examples here could be, you know, local nonprofits, local community organizations may identify, you know, a child who is at high risk of abuse and neglect or who has already been exposed to violence, respond very quickly, support that family, support that child, but also then work with them to get them the medical care that they might need, to get them to counseling and psychological support that might be appropriate, to get them to housing services that the county or the state are providing. But it's often the nonprofit that is providing that very first link to get them the immediate help and support they need to then allow them to progress into kind of more sustainable services.
Can you talk about how those in charge of this levy, so the Clackamas County, who I obviously will be in charge of this levy, will be held accountable for the funding? You know, there's going to be various measures for Clackamas voters to be voting on, and many folks are stressed about finances. Can you talk about why this is a necessity in terms of funding?
Yeah, so again, you've asked some great questions. So another way of asking that is, you know, why this levy and why now? And is it a good investment for the average voter to pay a tiny little bit more? I think it's the price of a couple coffees per week additional in property taxes. So why now is, first of all, it's a tiny investment, and like I answered it, said a little bit earlier, is a very small investment now and a very small amount of money now to help prevent further trauma and abuse, you know, really pays dividends and saves a lot more money for us as taxpayers down the line when kids are more successful, kids are more successful as adults, and then our communities are more successful. And that's both in their health and happiness, but also economically.
And for listeners who want to read the material that you are just now talking about, can you give any resources, websites for folks listening?
So our website is yesforclackamaskids.org. So that would be all one word, yesforclackamaskids.org. So that's, you know, that will be where all of the information on the children's safety levy itself, you know, and how it's going to voters, etc.
Simon, is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted to include in this conversation?
I think the only thing not to ask is, you know, if you can air this, or, you know, it's a call to action is, you know, for anyone who's in your listening audience, who's a Clackamas County voter, or is not, but should be a registered voter, is, you know, we really need, our communities need you to support this measure. We need you to advocate for it with your friends and your families and in your communities and your church, in your place of work, wherever it is that you go. If you hear about this, if it comes up in conversation, or if you can start the conversation, and again, just to say, you know, yes for Clackamas Kids, this is a really once in a lifetime opportunity to invest in some much needed services to keep kids safe.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBOO Evening News.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
On today's News in Depth, a report and sounds from this last weekend's protests from KBOO News' street team. I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Depending on how you count it, Friday marked day 78 or 79 of continued protest here in Portland, Oregon. Friday evening saw protesters meeting at Peninsula Park in North Portland, where they intended to march to the Portland Police Association's headquarters, a mile and a half away, but were stopped by a line of police officers within a few blocks of their leaving the park, where police announced that protesters needed to move off the roadway. Protesters marched down a different street, leading eventually to Interstate, where police would declare an unlawful assembly. Here are some more sounds from Friday night. Saturday afternoon saw a counter-protest being held in front of the Justice Center by right-wing supporters, who said they were protesting the sustained nightly protest against the police. Counter-protesters were met with Black Lives Matter supporters who stood in Chapman Square. The two groups broke into arguments repeatedly, with several Black Lives Matter supporters being maced by a counter-protester. As the counter-protesters left the Justice Center, the two groups continued to clash, leading to confrontations that included the use of bear mace and paintball guns by counter-protesters. The two groups arrived at the Smart Park Garage on 4th and Yamhill, where at least one person was shot in the face by a paintball gun and sustained an injury. The right-wing counter-protesters were seen firing paintball guns from inside the stairwell of the parking garage down onto people on the sidewalk below. Two shots were fired from the driver's side of an exiting vehicle from what witnesses are saying looked like a pistol. KBOO spoke to a witness who was there at the parking garage but does not wish to be identified.
Coming straight out the car, they came out the parking garage. I don't know if that was a burnt orange color car. It was like a burnt orange. And then there was a blue car, and then shots were fired. And somebody collected the shell casings, actually.
How many shots did you hear?
Two or three, at least.
Shortly after the shooting, an improvised explosive device, or IED, detonated next to Black Lives Matter supporters after being thrown from a vehicle on Main between 4th and 5th. No police reported to either the scene of the shooting or IED to investigate. Independent journalist Alyssa Azar was also on the scene and live streaming at the time of the explosion. Here is her audio of the explosion.
Whoa! What the f***? What the f***?
They just threw...
Black, older Tahoe SUV just threw a bomb GMC. On 4th and Main.
They just threw a bomb.
Older black Tahoe threw a bomb on 4th and Main.
Oh my God.
I spoke with Alyssa today for further details of what she witnessed.
Yeah, so you were at the time live streaming, and if you go onto social media, you can see the video that you took. You're speaking into the camera, and then there's a car that you see driving behind you, and then in the video, I see that your attention is drawn off screen, and then you hear some kind of loud bang happen. So can you describe what happened in that moment? You kind of mentioned that you noticed the car behind you.
Yeah, I noticed the car behind me, and then I was looking at the car before it threw the bomb out, because the car had already drawn attention because of how aggressively it turned the corner aggressively twice before this happened, and then it came down kind of fast and sudden out of nowhere. So that's why I was looking at it, because other people had called attention to the car. And then kind of right as my head was turned, I saw him throw the pipe bomb out the window, and then it went off, as you can see or hear in the video. And there was definitely confusion for a second. It was loud. You just saw sparks for a second, and then a bunch of smoke, and the ground was shaking from the sound as it went off, like, I don't know, maybe 10 feet behind me.
Was anybody injured?
No, there was no one injured.
That was independent journalist Alyssa Azar, whose reporting can be found on Twitter and Instagram at Revolutionary Daddy, with a number 3 instead of the letter E in the word revolution. Later that evening, KBOO News team reporter Nat Moon attended the Saturday evening direct action that gathered at Laurelhurst Park and marched to the Penumbra Kelly Building.
Yeah, so on Saturday, police allowed the march to assemble in front of the building. As the crowd arrived, they started making announcements that people who commit crimes will be subject to arrest or force. People continued milling around for a few hours. There was music, there was, you know, the usual snack truck and medics passing out supplies, some speakers, and at around midnight, they did declare a riot.
And did you witness or did you hear from anybody as to why the police declared a riot?
I at the time, it was very quiet. In terms of there wasn't a lot going on within the crowd beyond, you know, protesting, standing in front of the building and communicating with the police from what I saw. I later read that there were some things going on, including like shining lasers at the police, and supposedly some rocks were thrown, but I didn't see any of that myself. And there were a lot of people, as the riot was declared, there were multiple people around me who looked around in disbelief and were like, this is a riot? But as soon as the police came out, I would say about 10 or 15 minutes later, after declaring a riot a few times, they came out extremely aggressively against the shield wall that had assembled in the driveway.
And what did that look like? Was there any sort of release of gas or munitions that night?
There were some munitions that night. Definitely a lot of flashbangs. Supposedly there was smoke employed, but not tear gas. I saw a lot of baton usage. I saw a lot of singling people out for arrest. I saw a lot of intimidation of press and medics. A flashbang was fired at the feet of press who were assembled on the grass of a sidewalk on Burnside. And I saw a lot of aggressive force by the police. I saw someone get singled out who was walking on the sidewalk carrying a shield. They were singled out and arrested.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Nat, for the update about what happened on Saturday night. We'll be seeing you on KBOO News.
Thank you, Jenna.
Sunday saw day 80 of the Portland protest. In the afternoon, I attended the family's March for Black Lives, which marches every Sunday afternoon from Salmon Springs to the former site of the Elk statue near the Justice Center. This Sunday's march saw the families march past a Back the Blue counter-protest that was also protesting in front of the Justice Center. People of all ages attended the march that ended back at Salmon Springs. The Justice Center saw continued gatherings with a large crowd gathering to support Letha Winston, mother of Patrick Kimmins, who was killed by police in 2018. She held an event that she called A Change Is Going to Come. Well, that's the Portland protest update from your KBOO News Street Team. Pictures and videos of KBOO Street Team's coverage of our local news can be found on our social media. Just check out KBOO's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. To join the KBOO Street Team, contact our news director at newsdirector@kboo.org. To end our news in depth today, here's audio from the closing chant from Sunday's Families March for Black Lives.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support one another.
We must love and support one another.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support one another.
We must love and support one another.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom.
It is our duty to win.
It is our duty to win.
We must love and support one another.
We must love and support one another.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Officer, all power to the people. Repeat after me. All power to the people.
All power to the people.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you for joining us. Just before we jump into our show, the main content of our show tonight,